Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, recent discoveries have raised excitement levels around the possibilities of alien life on other planets. We thought we might take a closer look at planetary neighbours near and far. And here to guide us on this whistle-stop intergalactic tour is physicist and associate professor Shane Bergen from UCD. Hi, Shane.
All aboard.
This is exciting, isn't it? Very exciting. We're going to take a whistle-stop tour, as we say, around the planets. But we'll get the basics first. How many of them are there?
It depends, right? Yeah. When I was in school, I was taught that there were 9 planets. But since then, poor old Pluto has been demoted. So we have 8 planets in our solar system.
What do we call Pluto now?
Well, we call it a sort of a dwarf planet. Unfortunately, it just doesn't meet the criteria to be a planet. There is a test. There's an admissions test.
And what is that? What standards do you have to
do? Three things. First, you have to go around the sun, as opposed to like a moon, which goes around a planet. So it meets that criteria. The second one is that it has to be larger than the so-called Pedato radius, which means that it's a lumpy rock in space that's so big that the force of gravity starts to round it. So it looks planetoid as opposed to just like a lump or a potato. Mm-hmm. And asteroids tend to look like that. So it meets that criteria too. But it doesn't meet the last one. It isn't top dog in its neighbourhood. It doesn't kind of sweep up other objects because of its massive size. So unfortunately, Pluto is in an area full of kind of debris at the outer edges of the solar system. So it doesn't meet that last sort of rather kind of hairy criteria for being a planet. So unfortunately, it's not in the club anymore. But whilst I was told about 9 planets in school in 2006, Pluto lost its edge. Since then, we've discovered thousands of other planets in solar systems other than our own.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Really
will we talk about the ones closest to the sun maybe first? That's our starting point.
Right. So if we come out from the sun, the first one we'll meet is Mercury, and it's the smallest planet, and it's a planet of extremes. So a day on Mercury is incredibly long. So it takes 176 Earth days for it to do one revolution. And so it means when it's facing the sun, it's going to be incredibly hot. It's 400 Celsius on the surface of Mercury, hot enough to cook a pizza. But on the opposite side, in the nighttime, it's minus 180 degrees. And this planet is under huge stress and strain. It's actually contracting. So it's wrinkling like a raisin. And so using telescopes, we're able to see massive cliffs on the surface of Mercury showing that the whole planet is contracting. And it's under huge extreme pressures
and
temperatures.
And then the cold causing this cracking. And you describe it as being raisin-like in places.
Absolutely. And moving out then from Mercury, we meet Earth's twin, but perhaps its evil twin, which is Venus, sometimes called the morning star. Venus is very odd. It rotates backwards. So the sun rises in the west and sets in the east.
Why does it? Do we know why it does that?
No, I haven't a clue why it does that. And a day on Venus takes 243 Earth days. So a long day for any Venetian citizens. But we can't really see the surface of Venus that well because it's covered in a very, very thick atmosphere. Clouds of acid, horrible acids that make it the most extreme planet to live on. It is the warmest of the planets in our solar system because of a massive greenhouse effect. And whilst it often is said to kind of be Earth's twin, I think it was just from the fact that it looked beautiful in the sky, and maybe long, long time ago, people thought maybe there was life on Venus.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like it's even worse than Mercury.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we're Earth, and we're the perfect spot. We're in the Goldilocks zone. And we know a lot about ourselves. And moving on beyond Earth, we reach Mars, which is the planet that every billionaire wants to go to at the moment.
This is where Jeff Bezos is going to live, isn't it?
Yeah, and Elon Musk is going to be his next door neighbour, and we could probably spend a half an hour talking about the psyche of both of those gentlemen as to why they might want to move humanity to a new planet rather than just looking after our own. It's half the size of Earth. It has a very thin atmosphere. It's a rather extreme place to live, and it wouldn't be extremely habitable. So the idea of trying to terraform a planet like Mars is just nuts in most scientists' opinion. That being said, we're very interested in the surface of Mars because we think once upon a time there were massive oceans and rivers on Mars. And so it may once have been habitable. It might have it might have had very primitive life on Mars.
But it has these wild dust storms now, doesn't it?
Yeah, so there's absolutely...
It's very unpleasant as well.
Yeah, there's no hope of there being life on Mars right now, but we might see fossilized remains. But yeah, the red planet, so-called, because there's a lot of iron in its surface, so it's rusty, effectively. And we have a number of rovers on Mars at the moment, from NASA, from the European Space Agency, even the Chinese have rovers there, and they're all scraping and sniffing the surface of the planet, looking for clues around organic life. And every month I read a new discovery that basically is moving a step closer to saying, yeah, the likelihood of there once having been life on Mars is increasing. Haven't found anything definitive, but we're always inching towards that positive discovery.
Why is that the one that they're focused on when they're looking at a future holiday destination, the big guys?
Well, it's near, and I suppose it's much more hospitable than Venus, and it's rocky, so you could land on it. The only rocky planets are Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars. So you'd have to pick one of those. And Mercury and Venus are just completely inhospitable and too hot. So Mars would be their preferred destination. But as I said, it's bonkers. The idea of sending a person to Mars that doesn't have anything like what we would have here in terms of the ingredients for basic habitability, like water, like a radiation shield, pleasant temperatures, these sorts of things. You couldn't live there very, very sustainably at all. But maybe a couple of billionaires might fancy heading off. Maybe the rest of us might send them.
We might. Listen, let's go beyond the rocky neighbourhood, as you've just described it there so well, and we arrive at the gas giants.
Yeah, so the big one first, Jupiter. Jupiter's so big that you could fit all the other planets in the solar system inside it. And a day on Jupiter only takes 10 hours. So it spins incredibly fast. It's gassy. And so because of the fact that it's gassy and it spins very, very fast, it actually wobbles. So it kind of flattens out a little bit. It is absolutely huge. And it has a huge big storm on the surface of Jupiter called the Eye. And it's been raging for about 350 years. It was first discovered or spotted by Galileo using its telescope. And it's almost like a mini solar system of its own. It has countless moons around it. I think it's about 76 moons orbiting Jupiter. And one of them, called Europa, is a potential harbinger of life. So we wonder, Europa has an icy sheet. It may have liquid oceans below it. And we're sending the so-called Europa Clipper at the moment. It's hurtling its way through space right now, launched in 2024, estimated time of arrival 2030. And it's thought that it might be able to look for clues of life on Europa. Wouldn't that be absolutely amazing?
It certainly would. I'm just going back to what you said earlier about the gravitational pull giving the planets the round shape. So what's happening with Jupiter that it's sort of stretched?
Yeah, so it's held together in a sphere because of gravity, right? And that would be a perfect sphere if it weren't moving. But because you're adding in this twist, you're spinning it, and because it's made of gas, it means that the equator will kind of fatten and the poles will thin. So you kind of get this oblong shape. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Earth does the same, but it's not quite as extreme. The Earth is not a perfect sphere. The Earth is fatter at the equator because of the spinning effect.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Saturn then. Beautiful Saturn with its rings.
Rings, absolutely. We liked it so much we had to put a ring on it. And those rings are made of rock and ice, and they're so noticeable. It's the glitzy planet. It's my favourite. It has well over 100 moons. One of its moons, Titan, is even bigger than the planet Mercury. So it's an incredible place. But the rings are very, very thin. Whilst they're thousands of kilometres wide, they're only a couple of metres thick. So it's like a pancake. And it's actually thought that they might disappear in the future. And it's a remarkable planet. We know little about it relative to Jupiter, but we're always sending out new missions to discover more and more about these outer gassy planets. And beyond Saturn, we have Uranus, which spins on its side. So its north pole is on the side. So it's 90 degrees over, and we don't really know why. And recently we discovered a day on Uranus is slightly longer than we'd previously thought using new equipment. And beyond it, then we have Neptune, the windiest place in the solar system, with absolutely incredible winds of thousands of kilometers an hour. All of these are extreme places. You know, we are so fortunate to live on a rock that has water and has an atmosphere and has a magnetic shield, so that everything that has ever existed can be in this one beautiful place where the biosphere on its surface is literally tiny in the expanse of the universe. The area in which life exists, like below our feet, there's rock. not that far up into the sky, completely inhospitable. But we live in this kind of thin film of life. And I think we take it for granted
we
so
do.
Easily. And mm-hmm. yet it's so precious. It's so rare. We haven't discovered anything like it anywhere else. And we've been doing a lot of looking.
Right. The exoplanets, though, I mean, might we come across something there similar to ourselves?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And every scientist just waits with bated breath for the day where we discover something that's a little bit more Earth-like. We've discovered north of 5,000 so-called exoplanets, planets that are going around other stars, not our own sun. And we are starting to see rocky planets around these stars. And the way we do it is remarkable. We do something called a transit observation. So it's like trying to see kind of a fly go in front of a lighthouse. You're looking at the brightness of a star, and planets don't give out light of their own. So you have to wait until the planet goes in front of the star and you see a very, very small decrease in the intensity of the star.
So if there's a flicker.
You're
looking at the star and there's a flicker, that might be a planet.
Might be a planet. And not only can we tell it's a planet, we can tell how big it is. And now we can tell if it has an atmosphere, and we can also tell what might be in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for more and more clues of things that we might associate with Earth-like conditions. And as well as having observations, we now use things like artificial intelligence to try and figure out which planet we should point our telescopes at. So recently, a study from Switzerland showed that there are 44 Earth-like planets that we should be looking at with our telescopes. So they used an artificial intelligence to sift through tons and tons of data and use something called machine learning from kind of known data sets to extrapolate where we should be looking. In other words, where the most likely sites for Earth-like planets are. And they'll use things like the James Webb telescope to look out into those corners of space for these rocky worlds.
James Webb, we heard a lot about that when, you know, it first started to work. Is it still showing us amazing things?
There isn't a week that goes by that there isn't a world-class research paper that comes from the James Webb telescope. It's absolutely incredible. It does things near, so that's the reason we know that days on Uranus are slightly longer than we'd previously known. We're looking at exoplanets, we're looking at the birth of galaxies, we're looking at the origins of the universe. It's a time machine. Like, it's able to look out into space, into every corner, at multiple different things and tell us so much about the place we live in, our universe.
Now, we started all of this because we said hopes had been raised about alien life having been observed recently. So what has been happening?
Yeah, here's James Webb again, right? So James Webb recently was able to detect particular molecules in the atmosphere of an exoplanet, right? Just think about that for a second. To observe something that doesn't give out light, 100 and something light years away, and to be able to tell the chemical makeup of the atmosphere.
It's mind-boggling.
It is. And they discovered two chemicals in the atmosphere that on Earth we know only come from the output of biological processes. In other words, something alive sort of excretes these gases. That's the only way it's created here on Earth. And so we've seen it now on another planet. So it's perhaps one of the most promising clues that there may be very primitive life on a far off planet. Now, we can't say for sure that life is causing it in this other world. There may be another thing that's causing it there. But it is a really tantalizing clue. It's something we'll have to focus in an awful lot more on. And James Webb is going to continue to look at this distant world.
So we have
world.
James Webb doing that. And you mentioned the Europa Clipper as well.
Yeah.
That's one to watch, is it?
The Europa Clipper will arrive on the Jupiter moon Europa in the year 2030. And it's going to look for signs of organic life on the subsurface of the moon Europa.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And if we can show that once upon a time life existed on Mars, or once upon a time the ingredients for life existed on Europa, then it shows that life on Earth is not unique. And if it's not unique to Earth, and it may have existed in these nearby places in the past, it's quite likely that it exists in multiple places around the universe. The universe is huge, so the likelihood of there being life on other worlds is not small. The likelihood of us getting in touch with them, and the likelihood of them being intelligent like us and lasting long enough is a whole other day's discussion. You know,
we don't know.
We don't know. And we also know that civilizations like ourselves may only exist for the blink of an eye, because we have it within ourselves to destroy ourselves as much as we do to look out into the heavens to look for places like us.
I should ask you how the planets formed in the first place, now that you've taken us through them all.
Yeah, our sun and the planets around it are all due to kind of dust in space gathering together. The vast majority of all the dust gathered in the middle, and it formed the sun. And so it's hydrogen and helium that's burning and giving out massive amounts of heat and light. Everything else is detritus that was just going around the sun, and they formed the planets. But all of the stuff of the planets came from the death of a previous star. So we're all made from stardust. Everything in the Earth, everything in Mars, everything in Jupiter, everything in your phone and in your head came from the explosion of a previous star. That's where all the elements in the universe came from, except from hydrogen and helium, which came from the Big Bang. But all the ingredients that make up everything came from the birth of a star. As Joni Mitchell said, we are stardust.
And the planets and the moons in our solar system, they're not the only things out there, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I skipped over so much when I was taking you on this whistle-stop tour. Between Mars and Jupiter, there's an asteroid belt. So there are all these kind of lumps of rock that perhaps may have been able to form a planet but didn't quite get there. And then when you go out to the gassy regions of the solar system, you have the Kuiper Belt, which is another area of rocky debris. And then beyond Pluto, we have the so-called Oort cloud, which is just all the fringy bits at the edge. And sometimes they produce comets that come in close to the sun, and we see them in the night sky, of course, in their beautiful tails as the icy comets start to evaporate and turn their ice into vapour as they move toward the sun.
Incredible. I feel like we've been away. We have. We've been on a virtual journey. Thank you so much for that, Shane. That's Shane Bergen, who is Associate Professor at UCD.